using animal characters to process our own human traumas.
It gave me a sense that perhaps there could be a way to look at these massive conflicts that we've all almost lost sense of how to feel for because the suffering is so immense. But if we could take an animal's eye view on them, then maybe we could feel our way back into some kind of genuine empathy.
That's Caradwyn Dovey. Her wonderful and wondrous new story collection explores war through the eyes of animals. It's called Only the Animals. Then a novel from the 1930s is selling like hotcakes in 2017, as people wonder, could it happen here?
Eventually, during the course of the novel, as the country spirals further and further into fascism, Winthrop becomes very paranoid. He becomes afraid of what he's created because I don't think that he realizes the magnitude of the changes and how angry and frustrated and afraid people are, and the country just becomes worse and worse.
That's Sally Perry, director of the Sinclair Lewis Society. We talked with her about Lewis's novel, It Can't Happen Here. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. A cat belonging to the French cabaret performer Colette dies in the trenches of World War I. A blue mussel, on the quest for self-knowledge a la Jack Kerouac's On the Road, is killed during the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And a dolphin, sent to Iraq by the U.S. Navy, writes a letter to Sylvia Plath before perishing in the conflict. These are three of the 10 animals whose souls tell their stories in Caradwyn Dovey's new collection, Only the Animals. Each has been killed in a human conflict of the past century or so, and tell the story of their deaths in turn. Haunting, poignant, and sometimes mordantly funny, the stories illumine our relationship to animals and vice versa. But Only the Animals also explores how other writers have used animal characters to talk about the horrors humans inflict on themselves and other beings. Think Gunter Grass's Flounder or George Orwell's pig, Napoleon. Caradwyn Dovey says that she, like other writers, uses the imagined voices of animals to awaken radical empathy, not only for the animals we humans affect so heedlessly, but also for ourselves. In addition to Only the Animals, Caradwyn Dovey is the author of the novel Blood Kin. She also writes for The New Yorker magazine. Well, Caradwyn Dovey, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book was such a joy to read, both poignant, sad, and very funny. Only the Animals is a book of biographical stories told by the ghosts of animals, most of whom have died in some kind of service to humans in wars, it seemed. Where did the idea to write this kind of story come from?
I think my parents were particularly worried when I initially told them I was working on a book told from the perspective of 10 dead animals. I had had a period of not really having much success with some fiction projects I'd been working on. And I'd had a baby, which I actually felt was great in terms of the creativity and everything. But this book was my way of falling back in love with writing. And so that playfulness and the imaginative challenge, I suppose, that I set for myself to see if I could write from the perspective of dead animals and have a reader come with me on that journey. It was kind of just about, finding my own bliss in the process and the joy of writing. But in terms of the actual seed of the idea, I studied social anthropology at NYU many years ago, and I had a wonderful professor called Emily Martin who told a long story one day in class about a parrot that she had owned. And most people don't know that parrots are like toddlers, so they need an insane amount of love and care and emotional support to remain happy. And she told the story about how after, on the day of 9/11, she was in the faculty housing at NYU and had a clear view of the towers and was at home with her parrot. And the two of them saw the second plane hit together. And in the days and weeks that followed and the, you know, communal stress of the city, she noticed that the parrot was actually starting to self-mutilate and pull out its own feathers. And essentially it was trying to die. And she realized she would have to give it up for adoption. And there's a lot of parrot adoption centers out in Cleveland for some reason. So she drove, she took a cross-country trip out with this parrot on her lap, who she absolutely adored, to save its life if she had to give it away. And there was something about that story of that day and, you know, the incredible human suffering that was happening. But there was something so visceral about thinking of the suffering of this little parrot on that day too, that kind of gave for me this sense of radical empathy for not just the parrot, but anyone who was suffering on that day. And so that was the first story I wrote, and then I transposed it to Beirut. But it gave me a sense that perhaps there could be a way to look at these massive conflicts that we've all almost lost sense of how to feel for because the suffering is so immense. But if we could take an animal's eye view on them, then maybe we could feel our way back into some kind of genuine empathy.
Yeah, radical empathy is very much what animates, I think, all of these stories. Because they do involve war, almost all of them, except perhaps the first one, which involves colonialism in some way.
Yeah, that's right. So when I realized what I was doing, I mean, the first parrot story I just thought was going to be a short story, but then I wrote the ape one, which is set in World War One in Germany and was animated by a love of Kafka's work around animals. But then I realized, oh gosh, I could see a third one coming along. So I had to set limits and boundaries for the project. And so I decided to keep it within the 20th century because I wasn't, yeah, I could have gone a lot further back. So I wanted to really capture the turn of that, each turn of that century, so the beginning and the end. And, you know, of course, the first sort of stirrings of that colonial massacre that happened everywhere in the New World, much earlier, obviously, in America. But in Australia, that was really when those kinds of conflicts were happening. And then to capture the post 9/11 world with the final story set in Beirut in 2006 to kind of, you know, the tail end of that century, which, you know, was the bloodiest for all human history, but probably also for all animal history. And I think in some senses, those two brutalities go hand in hand.
These stories are very much told by the animals in relationship to human beings, most of them, although the story about the mussel, somewhere along the line, the pearl would be handed to me, is more the story of one mussel told by another rather than in relationship to humans. It's hard for me to point out any one favorite story, but I thought that was one of the funniest stories that I read. But very much these are told from the point of view of devotion and service of the animals to humans. I wonder why that's so.
So the second part of the project, so once I realized that I was going to play with this idea of looking at human conflicts through the eyes of an animal, that's a pretty dark and depressing view. And I knew I needed something else to lighten up the project and the perspective. And when I started to read around animals in literature and in 20th century literature, kind of casting around for ideas for how to do this and how to do it well, I was just bowled over by how many of the greatest authors of the past century had at some point turned to an animal narrator to say the thing that they wanted to say at that point. And so the project kind of took on a second level, which in a way I think is probably its most important, well, for me anyway, its most important meaning, which is you can actually see each of the stories as a a kind of love letter to an author who has certainly changed my perspective on the world through their writings on and around animals, all fiction writers. And so each story engages with one of these authors. So the animal in question may be inspired by that author's style or voice. So the influence may be made quite explicit. They may actually have biographical encounters with that author, some of them invented, some of them not. And that part of the project, I suppose, was also, you know, to come back to that idea of radical empathy, an affirmation, at least for me, of the power of fiction, not only to take us into different worlds, but to change how we treat each other. So, for example, when I started reading, you know, around the parrot, the first story that I wrote, one of the books that I've always loved is Julian Barnes's novel. I think it was from 1984, Flaubert's Parrot, which is just this wonderful, playful take on, you know, a biographer who's trying to track down the actual stuffed parrot from the Flaubert short story, A Simple Heart. And of course, it's a, you know, it's a bit of a lost cause. I think at the end, he gets to the museum and there's sort of several versions of the stuffed parrot. So, you know, the whole thing is a commentary on the futility of fact in biography. But, you know, so then I was reading around that and that sense of playing with the biography of an author, also using animals, led me to Virginia Woolf's work with writing through fictional created animals. I had never read her novel Flush, which is told from the perspective of a spaniel. And it's a take on Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the poet's life through seen through the eyes of her dog. And of course, Virginia Woolf was always playing with these ideas of biography. I think most of her books are questioning all the conventions of how we describe a life. So yes, the humor and the playfulness and the love that I hope does shine through in these stories. Many of the animals have this kind of love for the author or the humans that they're interacting with. And for me, that was an expression of my own adoration for these writers who've come before me.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Caradwyn Dovey about her new short story collection, Only the Animals. Yeah, so Plautus is, you know, emblematic of what you're just talking about. Plautus, an autobiography of my years on Earth and last days in space. This is the story of a tortoise who goes from living with Alexandra Tolstoy to Virginia Woolf. And at one point, is it the tortoise that says, or is the tortoise quoting someone else, that Gogol and Tolstoy dared to imagine themselves into the mind of an animal? Both could at one stage find no way to say what they wanted to say, except by making that animal speak for them.
I think that's the tortoise just spouting forth his own, her own wisdom, sorry. But yeah, the tortoise one was a way to look at the Cold War as the, you know, major conflict. But it was really fun to write because I gave this tortoise a very long and literary life. And it was a way to, again, pay tribute to those authors who'd written through the mouthpiece of an animal. So the Tolstoy short story where he wrote it entirely from the perspective of a horse. And then, of course, later in the tortoise's life, so he goes to England, to Virginia Woolf for a little while, and then ends up in the hands of George Orwell, who at that stage is in a tramping phase. So George Orwell actually did used to kind of go slumming to gather material for his books. And he would take on another name, Burton. And so the tortoise is owned by him for a while. And that was a way to, again, pay tribute to Orwell's amazing imagination and the way that he used animals, which is obviously quite different, using them through as a form of political satire. But, you know, not many people know that when Animal Farm was originally published, well, first of all, he struggled immensely to get it published. And when it was first published, it actually was published as Animal Farm, : A Fairy Tale, which in some ways for me changes the whole meaning of the book and almost softens it a little bit and puts him in the same category as many of the other post-Second World War fabulists who were using fable as a form of not only political critique, but a way to deal with national trauma. So in some of the other stories, there's an elephant story where the animating author beneath it is José Saramago, who was a Portuguese author also writing in that post-war period, who would often write through animal characters. And also Günter Grass, another of the stories is set in Nazi Germany and told through the perspective of a dog who is owned by Himmler. And that story is dealing with the way that the German writer Günter Grass was also using animals in his fiction to find a way to speak of the unspeakable, essentially, of what had happened in Germany. So many of his characters in his novels are animals. You know, he writes from the perspective of rats and flounders, dogs, fish. And he, I think, found in animals the ideal symbol for alienation. But the light around all of that, too, I think, is that in using animals in this way, they were also trying to find a way to form a new positive myth of what their countries could be. You know, in both Portugal and Germany, I think the traumas of the wars and dictatorships that were endured meant that the national imaginary kind of had to get disowned in order for the country to move forward. But turning to animals in that way takes us back a bit closer to a tradition of folklore, I suppose, or fable, where there's still a sense of animals as having magical powers that we should respect. And even the word fable, you know, the origins of the word is to give voice. So again, that sense of giving animals a voice as a way to help us process our own human traumas.
These stories really hold up a mirror to us, but they're on so many layers. I mean, there's something more than a mirror. For example, the story about the elephant, I, the elephant wrote this, has a theme of heroism, you know, heroism that comes out of heroic myth and then is transposed into the heroism of everyday life.
Yes, for me, part of the fascination of looking at humans caught up in these conflicts is exactly what you say, that, you know, it's a cliche in a sense to say it, but it brings out the very worst of us, but can also bring out the very best in us as a species. And I think that's, again, where some of the kindnesses, these very, very gentle, mostly unseen acts of kindness between humans in wartime and humans and animals in wartime. None of that would be, you know, in the official history books of any of these conflicts. But the, you know, the elephant story ends with the villagers who are essentially having to kill these elephants in order to survive themselves, making an offering of an orange to them. Again, taking us back to an old version of our relationship with animals, where we thanked them for their, you know, sacrifice each time we killed them. But another, when I was researching one of the other stories, the cat story, which is set in World War I, in the trenches at World War I, and this cat that's owned by the turn of the century French author Colette has accidentally made its way to the front. But when I was researching the stories of you know, trench warfare, came upon this weird little historical booklet that was all about soldiers' interactions with animals in the trenches. And it just sort of broke my heart that these men who were in this terrible situation, you know, they would bird watch. You know, the birds mostly disappeared. So when they did see one, they were very intrigued by it and they would save up crumbs to feed it. And there were a lot of cats and even some dogs that became pets in the trenches. The donkey handlers were also very often very attached to their donkeys, to their mules, and that's in the story where even though they had cut the mule's vocal cords so that they wouldn't bray and give away, you know, where the front line was, there were stories of the mule handlers who were bringing food or munitions to the front line. If they were caught in no man's land, if their little pack of mules was caught there, that the human handler would refuse to leave them there to die and would die with them. So again, it's a kind of reclaiming, I suppose, of not heroism so much as just, you know, these random, unrecorded, mostly unseen acts of kindness that can keep us human during some of the beastliest times of our lives.
So to speak.
Exactly.
So now to maybe the, in some way, the lightest story in the book, although it does end, of course, like all of them, with death in war, or almost all of them. And that is Somewhere Along the Line, the Pearl Would Be Handed to Me. Is that after Kerouac? It seemed like a kind of on-the-road story.
Yes, it is. And he was a bit of a wild card because, you know, he's not really known for writing about animals. But when I started writing the muscle story, I happened to be reading, not on the road actually, but a book that he wrote when he was in the Merchant Marines during World War II. And I think it was unfinished and it only got published widely a few years ago or more recently. But it's all about his experience in the Merchant Marines, and the way he writes about the sea and the sea creatures was just incredible. It's like a kind of, you know, sense of on the road, but it's on the sea, and the humans are the main action, but there's this very strong identification he has with all of the marine creatures around them. You know, again, I think that sense in wartime of you know, the surreal quality of life and paying closer attention to everything around you because of this heightened sense of reality. And so you can sort of see that happening in him, how his powers of observation of these other creatures around him and his sense of the absurdity of what the humans are doing comes through very strongly. So that was actually the one that then influenced me to write The Muscle in the style of On the Road. You know, The Muscle has a very good freewheeling time and, you know, kind of has a great adventure searching for himself, but then at the end, you know, realizes he has made a mistake and has accidentally settled down and then very sadly dies in the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But that also was a commentary on a little bit of the biography of Kerouac. You know, he was lauded as this, you know, beat author who, you know, inspired this whole generation of younger people and younger authors to follow the example that people thought that he'd set in his books. But he actually became a total recluse later in his life and a very grumpy one, who apparently would just sit around drinking beer and was very annoyed at all these young people who kept turning up on a pilgrimage to his home, expecting him to, you know, share his life wisdom with them. And became quite disillusioned at the end of his life. So I thought that was just, you know, an interesting take and something I had not known about Kerouac before.
And yet this muscle is still a young muscle who has a much more philosophical and maybe wider sense of the meaning of his life as he realizes he's going to die. You know, he's already told us about his musings on non-attachment, which I thought was a pretty cute thing for a muscle to think about.
Yeah, that was a really fun one to write. When I first, again, was setting the parameters for the project, initially I thought, okay, maybe one of the rules I should set myself is that I can only describe senses that the creature would actually have. But I very quickly threw that out the window because I realized, you know, muscles don't even have eyes. So I was going to get stuck pretty quickly. So it's a very human muscle and a very observant muscle too.
We're talking with Caradwyn Dovey about her new short story collection, only the animals. Now, in 2015, in The New Yorker, you wrote an article in which you spoke about imagining what old age is like, which I thought was a marvelous article, by the way. This book imagines, of course, stories from the point of view of animals, although much of that is pretty anthropomorphic. But you do attend to that, as you know, maybe with a muscle you couldn't do it as much as you could do with a chimpanzee. But tell us something about the process of imagining what you are not in order to write from that point of view.
Yeah, it's something that obviously I think about a lot. To be totally honest, the article that you're mentioning about imagining old age actually came out of my failure to successfully imagine myself into an old age character. So, you know, keep that in mind. I think taking a leap a leap of perspective like that can be very rewarding, but it's also often, I think, doomed to failure. It is something, I guess, with animals, I didn't have to worry about the ethical considerations of doing that kind of, you know, imagining into an alternate self. And I think that was very freeing for me because my work has traditionally been very aware of, the politics of who can write for whom and acts of representation. And I've always wanted to be very respectful and not overstepping a line that other authors claim should and must be overstepped. But I think coming back to my own personal history as a white South African who grew up in 80s South Africa, I think there was a sense always, and through my mother's work, she was a literary critic, a post-colonial literary critic. So her work was very much engaged with critiquing the assumption that others have the right to always imagine themselves into another person's reality. So the animals was great because it was a way that I could do that and challenge myself. And the excitement for me is finding that voice. And so with each story, I would sort of read around the conflict and then I'd read around the animal sort of biology. And then I'd read the author who was, you know, kind of inspiring the piece. And somewhere in that mix, mashing those three influences together, suddenly the animal's voice would kind of, come to me. And that part of it is a bit mysterious even to me. But I guess, you know, once you start hearing it, then, you know, at least, you know, there's something to follow. But yeah, in terms of other acts of imagination, the old age one, I felt in the end I had written a novel that had attempted to portray a series of characters in their 80s. And I had realized that I'd fallen into all the traps, the cliched representations of aged people that actually I think do a disservice to the elderly. And they're the same tropes that I see coming up over and over in films and books about elderly people. But it is happily, I think, a trend that is ending because more and more older people are actually writing their own stuff, you know, their own fiction, their own take on these things as old age changes, you know, in our perceptions of it and in people's experiences of it. But it also brings up another element to the way I think about writing, and that is that I've always felt quite allergic to writing autobiographically. Again, perhaps because of a sense of coming from, you know, a class of perpetrators, even though my family was very innocent in their own actions in South Africa, but I think a sense of not really having the right to have a voice or to bear witness. So for me, the only way I could have the confidence to write fiction was to do this kind of imagining, to really get as far away from myself and my life as possible. But as I get older, that's changing, and I'm hoping to find a way to, in a new project that I'm working on, to actually speak to that experience in a way that still remains interesting to others, but also respectful.
Well, I really look forward to talking with you about that project. In fact, I reflected to myself in reading the story about the dolphin. The dolphin at one point talks about how close she is when she gave birth to her baby, to her daughter, and just the whole experience of infancy, of her own child. I wondered if that's something that you were reflecting on when you wrote that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I wrote that story in a haze of milk-covered, you know, bliss after the birth of my first son. And yeah, I you know, the thing that I loved about Sylvia, so this dolphin story is told in the form of a love letter, really, to Sylvia Plath, who also often used animal metaphors in her poetry to really, you know, grind down that difference between the female human and the female animal. And she really, she celebrates the female animal in a way that I just found absolutely wonderful as a new mother myself. You know, people complain about all the, you know, difficulties of that process too, but I loved how in I read Sylvia Plath's journals, and there was this wonderful passage where she imagined herself as a mother and writing better because of it. So it wasn't the sense that it was a zero-sum game and that the one had to detract from the other, but that, you know, that it was a kind of power and an insight that she would draw on in her writing. And that's exactly what happened. You know, her writing was just luminous when she was, you know, mothering at the same time, and her connection to, just another sense of being part of a community of creatures on Earth. So yeah, that was a very cathartic story for me to write at that time in my life.
Yeah, it was very beautiful. Well, Caradwyn Dovey, your wonderful book is Only the Animals. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and I very much would like to take up the conversation again when your new book comes out.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me.
Caradwyn Dovey. Only the Animals is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. You'll also find a link to her article for The New Yorker, What Old Age Is Really Like. Next up, Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, is experiencing an explosive revival. We'll find out why after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, is a cautionary tale about the fragility of democracy and an alarming, eerily timeless look at how fascism could take hold in America. It chronicles the rise of Buzz Windrip, who runs his presidential campaign on making America great again by serving the needs of the, quote, forgotten man. Only once he's in office, Windrup wastes no time in transforming democracy into plutocracy, with himself as dictator. Labor and civil rights are abolished, the liberal press is declared the enemy of the people, and armed militias enforce obedience. Does some of that sound familiar? And could the rest of it come true? A lot of readers think so. Penguin Random House reissued It Can't Happen Here after the November election, and the sales were so phenomenal the publishers had to reprint it several times already. Called A Message to Thinking Americans when it was published, It Can't Happen Here is a shockingly prescient novel that remains as fresh and contemporary as today's news. I spoke with the director of the Sinclair Lewis Society, Sally Perry. I started out by asking her about the circumstances under which the book was written and originally published.
It came out in 1935, and, you know, if you think about what was happening in the United States in 1935, we were in the middle of the Great Depression. We were about 15 years or so removed from the end of World War I. And between the two, there was a lot of concern in the country about what was going to happen next. There was at least 20% unemployment, also lots of underemployment, and people were afraid. There were a number of fascist entities that were in the United States at that time. Probably the best known was Huey Long, who had been the governor of Louisiana and had run it very much like an autocracy, and then later became a U.S. senator. Also, Father Charles Coughlin, who had a very influential radio show and moved from being a supporter of social justice to becoming kind of an anti-Semitic demagogue. Lewis was writing in a time where also in Europe we had the rise of Hitler, of Mussolini. In the Far East we had a lot of Japanese militarism and the invasion of China. So things all over the place were, you know, very unsettled. In addition, Sinclair Lewis at the time was married to Dorothy Thompson, who was one of the best-known American foreign correspondents and probably the first American woman correspondent. In 1933, she had interviewed Adolf Hitler and not thought much of him. She wrote a book about him called I Saw Hitler! Exclamation point, in which she pointed out his failings. He threw her out of Germany, but that really just redoubled her efforts in terms of trying to understand the political situation in Europe. This is all put together, it became kind of a perfect storm for Lewis to write. He was, you know, he talked to Dorothy Thompson and a lot of the refugees that she met with. She was also friendly with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. So he had a lot of input and wrote the novel in what he called a white heat. So most of it was completed within 2 months.
Yeah, and there are some remarkable parallels to what is going on today. But before we get to them, why don't you give us a kind of brief overview of the plot of the novel?
It's an interesting novel. The protagonist is Doremus Jessup, who is an editor of a small newspaper in Vermont. And so we see much of what's going on through his eyes. What's interesting is that he sees himself, I think, like a lot of liberals do, like a lot of people who just assume that the country will kind of go along and that everything ought to work out. He sees what's going on with national politics. And so the novel kind of goes back and forth between what he's seeing and then the contest for the election. So in the election, it's split among Franklin Roosevelt, who loses this time, Walt Trowbridge, and Buzz Windrup, who presents himself as a man of the people. And actually, in the first half of the novel, the epigraphs at the beginning of every chapter are excerpts from his campaign biography, Zero Hour, Over the Top, in which he tries to present himself as sort of an everyman, somebody who speaks to the ordinary person, the person who has been forgotten by the powers that be. And, you know, a lot of people dismiss him as, you know, he's kind of a little out there. But enough people who feel that they have been ignored by mainstream society vote for him. Windrup is also very good at harnessing the underemployed, the people he calls the forgotten men, and also those who have kind of a a sense that the military has been failing as well. So he's developed a paramilitary group called the Minutemen that follow him around so that when he actually is elected, this paramilitary group is in place and he's able to make changes in the government much faster and in much more negative ways. At least that part has no correlation with today, which I'm glad to say. So basically, the first half is how he gets to be elected. And, among the parallels, we see that Windrip is a master of manipulating the media. He used the radio well. He used newspapers, public appearances. And at one point when Windrip is being nominated, Doremus Jessup goes to the nominating convention. And he comes away and he says, wow, that was really something. And five minutes later, he can't remember a thing the guy said, because it's all superficial, but the rhetoric is so powerful that it pulls people right along.
And that's one of the parallels that's been made to Trump, as a matter of fact, who's been described as a charismatic speaker, promising a whole lot, but without too many details.
That's right.
Yeah, and I wonder if you could also talk about the... what are some of the things Buzz Windrip promises to the people that earn their support and adulation?
Among the things that he talks about are making sure that people have employment. And so that's something that resonates now as well as then. The whole idea that those people who feel that others have gotten jobs, but they haven't, are now going to be treated well. And I think that that's one of the things that most resonates. Some of the other things include, well, making women go back home and stay there because that's what they ought to do, loosening the rights that African Americans have so that they are sort of reduced to taking only menial jobs. So basically, it's very white male-centered in terms of what he's trying to encourage. As one reads along, because he has 50, his what he calls his 15 points, which is obviously an echo of Woodrow Wilson's 10 points from the end of World War One. He says that basically he knows best, and that when there is a problem, everybody should just kind of defer to him. So, and the other things, too, will include putting all banking, insurance, bonds, and so forth under a federal central bank. So he's going to centralize a lot of the infrastructure of the country.
So he promises everyone $5,000 a year, which is about $88,000 in current dollars. This is during the time of the Depression. But once he gets into office, he actually establishes a kind of totalitarian plutocracy. So is he more of a con man than an ideologue?
I think so. I mean, there's also an interesting parallel between Steve Bannon and Lee Saracen, who is Windrip's speechwriter and who also wrote most of the campaign biography, kind of like the sort of the brains behind what's going on. Saracen is an ideologue. Windrip gets very caught up in this sort of thing. He sees himself as sort of a savior to the people. So whatever it takes, whether it's offering the money or making the country easier to govern by getting rid of those pesky congressmen, that sort of thing, whatever it takes is what he'll do. Eventually, during the course of the novel, as the country spirals further and further into fascism, Windrip becomes very paranoid. He becomes afraid of what he's created because I don't think that he realizes the magnitude of the changes and how angry and frustrated and afraid people are. And the country just becomes worse and worse.
So, and his book, Zero Hours, is not actually written by him, but by his right-hand man, a man named Saracen, who reminds the reader much these days of Steve Bannon.
Yes, Saracen is definitely an ideologue, and I think he's somebody that sees in Windrip a person who's very happy, taking in the adulation and everything, and mouthing sort of patriotic slogans, but doesn't think very deeply about the implications of what he's saying. And Saracen capitalizes on that. I hate to say that Windrup is stupid in some ways, but he is, because he thinks so much about the superficial aspects of what he's doing that he allows Saracen to manipulate him. And Saracen is really the one who comes up with the concepts of arresting congressmen for very minor infractions, with sort of reconfiguring the United States. So rather than having so many annoying states, you have territories. And the territories are much easier to control because there are fewer of them. Saracen also comes up with the idea of concentration camps, re-education camps. So, you know, we're seeing parallels with a lot that was going on at the time, both in the East and in the West. Now, I certainly hope we never get anywhere near that, but that's part of the sort of underlying plan that Saracen has that I'm not sure Windrup is very cognizant of.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Sally Perry. She's the director of the Sinclair Lewis Society, and we're talking with her about Sinclair Lewis's book, It Can't Happen Here. It's published by Penguin Random House, who recently reissued it, and it's been selling like hotcakes. Now, in this book, people are sent to concentration camps, and, you know, it's very much modeled on what was happening in Nazi Germany at the time. But this is not just a cautionary tale about something that just happens, but also it seems to me that Sinclair Lewis is trying to warn liberals about their own failings in preventing something like this. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yes, and that's quite true. I mean, he does specifically call out the liberals, calls them the lazy liberals, those people who assume things will work out, who think that, you know, things are going well enough, and stay sort of ignorant of what's going on with people who don't feel very well represented. And, you know, part of being a lazy liberal or just a lazy citizen in general is not taking part, not paying attention when things happen that are contrary to what you believe, not calling you because you just think it'll work out eventually. So one of the things that I think that Lewis is doing is really warning citizens that they have to be much more vigilant and more educated, because democracy is a much more fragile thing than I think a lot of people think, and that if some ideologue sort of holds on to the reins and takes the country in a direction that you don't like or you think is dangerous or think is contrary to American values, if you haven't been doing anything up until now, there can be real problems. And I certainly hope that It Can't Happen Here is sort of a dystopian fantasy of what would happen if issues got taken to sort of a radical extreme. But certainly the beginnings of it, I think, are something that, you know, everybody needs to be thinking about now. I've heard that a lot of congressmen and senators claim that their staffers, their voicemail and all that has been filled with people trying to voice their opinion, way more so than ever before. And I think that people are starting to say, oh, you know, in order for it not to happen here, we have to speak up. We have to make our voices heard. We just can't sit back and see what awful thing might happen next.
Yeah, but there's another warning too. And that's also one that's very relevant. And that warning is, I mean, you know, there's another character in this book, Shad LaDue, who is a handyman, and he's been looked down on. I mean, this is very much talking about the politics of resentment. And the reason I mention that is because I think one of the points that Sinclair Lewis is making is that the class prejudice and elitism of the liberals has also played a role.
Oh, I think that's definitely true. You know, we like to think that it's other countries, European countries or foreign countries in general, that have much more of a class system, and that with the idea of American exceptionalism, we've grown beyond that. I think that one of the things that Lewis does in the novel is point out that there really is a lot of class resentment, and that those people who are better educated, who are often white, often, you know, financially pretty well-to-do, don't see the people who, say, are the handymen or the waitresses or the people who clean the streets or whatever. And that causes a lot of resentment. At one point, Doremus Jessup has actually jokes with his son about Shad Ledoux and wonders whether he can actually read or not, and refers to him in very condescending and negative terms. And Ledoux has worked for the family for a number of years, and you get the impression he's not the greatest worker in the world. But there's sort of a mutual antagonism. And so when Windrup gets elected and says, okay, great, we're going to give jobs to those people who don't have them or who feel underemployed, and Ledoux becomes part of Windrup's Minutemen. He gets a uniform. He gets a better salary. And, you know, now the tables are turned, and Jessup is afraid. And part of his fear is, well, all along, I've been treating him as something that's not very important, not subhuman exactly, but close. And, you know, any time that you start treating some people, whether it's a group of people or a race of people or an ethnicity or whatever, as something a little less than human, a little less than what you are, you're building the seeds for a lot of class resentment, which, you know, can certainly come back to bite you.
Now, you must know this novel like the back of your hand, right?
I do indeed. I've taught it many times. I always teach it before presidential elections.
Wow. Even before this?
Oh, heavens, yes. I heard from a student I had when I first started teaching back in the early 1990s, and he was in one of my first Introduction to Fiction classes, and we did It Can't Happen Here at that time. One time when there was a presidential election and Ross Perot was the third-party candidate, I taught the novel, and it was interesting because the description of Buzz Windrup was very, very similar to what Ross Perot looked like. The class was so terrified, everybody went out and registered to vote, and then everybody in the class voted except for one young woman who came and apologized to the class because she felt so bad.
Wow.
It was really powerful in terms of civic engagement that they were seeing the parallels. And, I don't see a literature class as a way to, preach politics or anything, but I was very impressed that the students could read this novel from 1935 and see parallels between what was going on in presidential elections and what was going in on the novel. And, you know, it made for an incredibly fruitful discussion.
So, looking at the run-up to this election, what were your sentiments before and after?
Well, you know, I think, like many people, I didn't take Donald Trump seriously. And I think that that's because, well, and I must admit, this is kind of a condescending position to be in. You know, I saw him as primarily a reality star, and I don't really watch that kind of television. The other thing is, I used to live in New York in the 1970s and 1980s, and I was aware of the some of the very troubling things he was doing with his buildings, and that prejudiced me against him from the get-go. You know, I've been amazed that he's been able to maintain his popularity, especially given some of the things that he says that go very contrary to what the Republican Party as a whole has, has been espousing for quite some time now. So, you know, if we weren't living in the middle of it, it would be very interesting to see how this will kind of work out, since whether the Republicans see him as somebody they can work with, or will there come a time when his ideas, his values, or the values that Steve Bannon is telling him about are going to be so contrary to what the Republicans want that we're going to see some kind of fissure that can be very problematic, I think.
So going back to Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, Buzz Windrup puts in a plutocracy. I mean, that seems to be the most rapid thing. I wonder if this is another parallel in the book, because in many ways it seems like that's what the Republican Congress wants to do and has wanted to do for a long time, basically put the corporations in charge of the government. And this is something that Donald Trump is doing with his cabinet.
Oh, yeah. It's a very dissonant sort of thing for him to have claimed that he's sort of representing the common people because he speaks like somebody you'd be talking to in a bar. But at the same time that he's doing that, he's also appointing people. I see that Betsy DeVos, for example, just got put into the cabinet. It's not because of any expertise they have, but because they have a lot of money. And I find this very troubling, because it seems as though people who have already made it and have done well in whatever business they have, are being put in charge of the government. Back in the 1920s, of course, we had Hoover and Coolidge and whatnot, and they said, the business of America is business. And I think that this is kind of the descendant of those sorts of ideas. But, look what happened when the business of America was business. We had the Great Depression in 1929, and that lasted for well over a decade, and until we entered World War II and the economy got revived through the immense building of armaments and so forth, the country was in terrible financial shape. I'm very concerned that if there's a similar pattern, that we could end up back in another terrible recession again.
Right, and all the measures, weak though they may have been, that were set up, that were taken to avoid that from happening again, is being threatened to be undone at this point. Now, Sinclair Lewis himself, talk about his perspective, because he also ran for office. What would he have done if he'd been elected president?
Lewis never ran for office.
Sinclair Lewis didn't run for office? Oh,
no.
That's Upton Sinclair.
It's Upton Sinclair, yes. Although, actually, it's interesting. In their lifetimes, Upton Sinclair and Sinclair Lewis were actually mistaken for each other a lot. And they actually collected checks from various organizations for each other. When Lewis was young, he worked at Upton Sinclair's Utopian Community, Helican Hall in New Jersey. One of the things that actually affected Upton Sinclair's run for the governor of California was that shortly before that, Sinclair Lewis had written Elmer Gantry, which was an attack on evangelists, hypocritical evangelists. And people said, that's Sinclair. He wrote that book about evangelists. He must be anti-Christian. So even though it was a different author, the names were so similar that there was kind of a backhanded effects from that.
And Sinclair Lewis also mentions Upton Sinclair a number of times.
Well, they had kind of a friendly rivalry. As I said, Sinclair Lewis worked for him when he was just starting out. He left Yale and worked for Upton Sinclair at his place for about 6 months. They shared some interests about social justice that I think that were very important. Upton Sinclair was a teetotaler and disapproved of people who drank, and Lewis was a serious alcoholic, like actually many well-known American writers in the 20th century. So there was a lot of tension there, but they were both very serious critics of American society. I think that Sinclair Lewis probably had a better sort of bead on the American character, and so that's one of the reasons why a lot of his novels, even though they are set in a particular time period, still resonate to this day.
Well, Sally Perry, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, reissued by Penguin Random House. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
Sally Perry. She's the director of the Sinclair Lewis Society. It Can't Happen Here is published by Penguin Random House, with an introduction by Michael Meyer and an afterword by Gary Scharnhorst. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.